Well, it's 10 o'clock, so we might as well get started. I'm only planning on spending an hour here this morning. We've got a little family trip planned for this afternoon, so after work. So I have to make sure I get all my work done on time today. So this is part of the thing that's going to get curtailed. I see there's a bunch of questions already queued up. I don't see. I always try to look for some, see if the people who drop the questions in are also in the chat room, and they're not. Usually folks come into the chat room as they come. So let's get started. Grim Grizz, I'm presently watching the Bible and the Great Puzzle video you released. You said it can take a lifetime to process new material. I'm curious where the current processing is and your personal processing of the Dead Sea Scrolls in particular. I don't know a lot about the Dead Sea Scrolls, but the limited I do know is that they're, for many people, how they are regarded continues to change, partly based on how people sort of fit that particular community into their overall picture of Second Temple Judaism. So that's where, and so those texts, on one hand, are very interesting because they're obviously very old and they compare fragments to other ancient texts that we have of the Hebrew scriptures. But so these things continue to change. One document that was critically important in history was a very famous document called the Donation of Constantine. And that document was used to prop up church authority against civil authorities. Until, if I recall correctly, and you could just a little trip over to Wikipedia would bring this up right away. Until that document, I think at the time of Erasmus, was shown to have been a forgery. So part of the reason, so if you read Fatal Discord, and you listen to Philip Carey's History of Philosophy and Religion. Part of what happens in the Renaissance period is the texts get a big boost in terms of their reputation, what people think about them. After the Reformation, texts get a downgrade. And people start looking to empirical measures for truth and agreement. So, these things do continue to go up and down in time. Grim Grizz identifying as a doubter, I've always had affection for the Gospel of Thomas, despite the fact that I learned of its existence in a Schwarzenegger movie. Yeah, those Gnostic Gospels, they're rather late compared to the canonical Gospels, and they, when you compare them with the canonical Gospels, the agenda of the authors becomes increasingly clear in terms of their Gnostic agenda. Any of your thoughts in this ballpark would be appreciated. Oh, I don't know much about the Talmud or Kabbalah, so I won't. You can. I'm sure Jacob would love to talk about that. So, texts continue to. They're vitally important because they, in many ways, have the capacity to reflect the mind of the author. Whereas sometimes actions and other physical evidence from the past, we have to infer the mind, and so texts have a particular power, but they're always within context. And so the Dead Sea Scrolls in particular, the writers of that community had an agenda. Now, one might say, well, didn't the writers of the New Testament have the agenda of, you know, promoting Jesus Christ as the Son of God? Yeah, but at least we know what their agenda was. We're less clear on the agenda of Qumran and the writers of the Dead Sea Scrolls, and maybe a little bit more clear on Gnosticism. But Gnosticism is such a huge movement that to define it precisely today continues to be a project that people work on. All right, Melly writes, I would like to ask what changed in history that you see that brought us from death being the end, with maybe some hope of the faithful, to the fascination, I think Dante is an example, with eternally suffering that came about after the resurrection of Jesus. Okay. One of the things that is interesting, if you read the Bible carefully, is the assumptions of biblical authors at different times and places for what remains of human beings after death. So there's some famous examples. Saul presses the witch of Endor to bring Samuel up from the dead. The book of Psalms talks about Sheol. To the best of my knowledge, Sheol seems to be something comparable to Hades. Hades is the Greek version, which is fairly well known to us, of this realm of the dead, and it's sort of a shadowy place. In the intertestamental period, and depending on when you date the book of Daniel, at the end of the book of Daniel, there's a very clear sense, there's very clear teaching of resurrection. And so one of the changes that you see from, let's say, the Psalms of David to the time of Christ is a much more vivid sense of God's ability and willingness to raise the dead in terms of resurrection. You find on Martha's tongue when Jesus comes to Martha and Martha is grief-stricken at the death of her brother and trying to hold down her annoyance with Jesus over not getting there in time. Martha basically reiterates what I would imagine was the observant Jewish Sunday school teaching with respect to the resurrection of the dead at that point. I know that I'll see him on the last day in the resurrection, and Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. If you read, let's say, N.T. Wright, The Resurrection of the Son of God, he goes in quite exhaustively to the teachings in the Second Temple period around Jesus' time of what the resurrection was about, and the strangeness of Jesus' resurrection and how that changed the ideas of the early Christians with respect to the way things are. Now, they expected a general resurrection at the end of time, and here Jesus is risen from the dead, and this then prompts all of this talk about the latter days, the last days, the end times, that here now we are living in these end times, and we know that these are the end times because the resurrection of Jesus has begun. So that's clearly an impact there. Now, another little data point is if you look at Jesus' parable about Lazarus and the rich man. One of the difficulties in reading an English Bible is the word hell, because you'll just stroll through the NIV or any contemporary conversation and you'll keep bumping into this word hell. Well, beneath this English word hell, often the translators are either rendering Gehenna, which is the Valley of Hinnom, by Jerusalem that Jesus continues to use as imagery of what the Vulgate, the Inferno, and later we would call hell. But also there's Hades. And in the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, the rich man goes to Hades. And the rich man isn't terribly happy with his accommodation in Hades. And somehow he sees Lazarus in the bosom of Abraham. Okay, how are we to interpret all of this stuff? What do we mean by the bosom of Abraham? Well, also at the time of Christ, there's this teaching of the feast of the patriarchs, where, and this very much gets folded into this celebratory banquet at the end of the world. Jesus tells more parables about reward and perdition than anyone else that we have in the Bible. And so often, the image is that of parties, of celebrations, of banquets. So you have the wedding feast, you have the parable of the bridesmaids, the virgins, and the bridegroom. And you have all of these, stories where there's a locked door and there's outside darkness and gnashing of teeth, where the worm consumes. And so you have all this imagery that Jesus gives. And you have the sheep and the goats that we talked about a couple of weeks ago with Job's question. And so you've got all of these, this imagery. Now, somehow religious traditions try to hold on to their narrative threads. And so when we imagine things, we have to sort of imagine things as such. And so, well, how can we piece these disparate pieces together when we've got Sheol in the Old Testament, we've got Samuel, you know, basically being annoyed that, well, why did you bring me up? Well, why were you down, Samuel? Were you experiencing reward? You have Elijah going up to heaven in a chariot of fire. Well, what does that mean? Well, Samuel, I guess, wasn't quite as good as Elijah, because Elijah seemed to go up to heaven and not die and live with God, whereas poor Samuel gets buried and has to hang out in the underworld. And then you've got questions of Moses. Well, what about what happened with Moses? Well, did Moses go up with Elijah? And then you have the Mount of Transfiguration, where you have Moses and Elijah. And so on one level, that's sort of Moses and the prophets. On another level, there's always this speculation in Second Temple Judaism that Moses was assumed, the Assumption of Moses, an ancient famous book, that Moses likewise, just like Elijah, was brought up to heaven and didn't suffer the indignities of poor Samuel, who went down to Sheol. And David, of course, talks about Sheol as this realm of the dead, which sort of like Hades is shadowy. And again, nobody, we don't get to do question and answers with the writers of the Hebrew scriptures and get to quiz them about Sheol. We just sort of have the writings that they leave behind. So what do we do as Christians today? We take a look at all of this evidence and we try to put something together with respect to things that seem that we can place a lot of confidence in and things that we can't. And this is sort of where Protestants and Catholics and Orthodox begin to differ, because church fathers did a fair amount of speculating about some of these things because they're pastors and people ask them about it, just like people ask me about it today. So you can find books like The Bible and the Future by Anthony Hookema. He taught systematics at Calvin Seminary just before I got there. And it's really a very pastoral heart and a decent Reformed systematic theologian. And so he wrote very pastoral books that try to bring all these issues up to the front. And all of this comes together as a, at least for as sort of broad agreement with certain areas of disagreement between most of the historical Christian traditions, that based on what the Apostle Paul says, when we die, we go to be with the Lord, but we await a general resurrection. N.T. Wright also has an excellent book on this. N.T. Wright writes three layers of books: academic books, middle brow books, and really short, very public consumption books. His book on this is a middle brow book, and it's a good book. And he walks through all of these issues too, as does Anthony Hookema and some others. And so then debates arise as to, well, how, where does this millennium that we find in the book of Revelation, how does that fit in? What are we to consider about the lake of fire? You know, lately, eternal conscious torment has become a big topic on YouTube, and we debate eternal conscious torment. Tim Keller had a great line when someone came up to him and asked, well, all this vision of fire and pitchforks and devils with tails, is this what we ought to imagine as hell? And Tim Keller, who is not a liberal Protestant, basically says, well, you know, these are all images, and these are images that are meant to evoke ideas of things, and so treat them as images. And that's where you get a lot of speculation about, well, how can hell be full of fire when it's also darkness? So it's dark fire. And so, I mean, we often have the difficulty when we look at the symbolism and the images of the Bible, when we try to sort of sketch them on paper. And you see this all the time with especially apocalyptic literature, like portions of Ezekiel and Daniel and the book of Revelation, where we have all these symbolic images. And if you sort of try to write them down or make a picture of them, the pictures don't really work. And that's because what the authors are doing are piling up symbol on top of symbol in order to create a representation of an idea that won't necessarily fit together in a two-dimensional or a three-dimensional picture. So what Protestants like myself usually come to the conclusion with are a number of fairly fixed points. Number one, salvation is of the Lord. We are finally at God's mercy in terms of what he will do with us in the age to come. And those ideas have gotten only more complex since we understand better and better how integral our bodies are to our experience of consciousness. And actually, in many ways, this lends credence to the Christian idea of resurrection, rather than more Gnostic-y ideas of, well, when I die, the true me is a disembodied spirit, and I then float around like that for all of eternity. That's not Christian teaching, even though a lot of Christians preach it and hear it in church. So there are a lot of moving parts in this, but at least what seems to me is that there is such a thing as judgment. There is such a thing as, if I use the word eternal, eternal itself is a tricky word, because we think about eternal as a long time, an infinite amount of time, when eternal is also non-time. So this stuff gets really tricky fast when we try to paint pictures of it. But there's very much a sense of eternal reward and eternal punishment. And now, the way I finally deal with all of these questions is, number one, I try to recognize what I don't know and can't know. A lot of the speculation we do is simply projecting our current experience onto canvases we have zero experience with. The Apostle Paul writes about experiences that he had, which he talked about as tongues cannot describe. I can't describe the kinds of things that I saw. Okay, well, treat it as such. We can't talk about it. It's not that we're not permitted to talk about it. It's simply we're unable to talk about it. And the more self-aware we are, the more we recognize in ourselves that there are ideas that I have that I continually struggle to articulate and try to birth into the world in some recognizable, representable fashion, but don't always get a chance to. So finally, when it comes down to, okay, what happens beyond this dispensation, beyond this life, beyond this age, as the Bible calls it, beyond history? We have little tantalizing, evocative symbols and imagery, but finally we have to trust God with it, that we say, when it's all said and done, God will do what's right. Now, we can't help but sort of jump in as little judgers and say, well, I'll be the judge of what's right. Yeah, sure. And we all are. And that's sort of the mess that we as human beings are in. All right, I'll keep reading your question. No one thought those taken out of the flood would be raised again so that they could be eternally punished. That's right. And we were just in my men's group the other night. We were talking about the book of Job. And it's very interesting that Job basically says, I want to have my showdown with God before I die. Though most of us would say, well, I'll get to see God when I die. Notice the difference between Job's assumptions about the way the world works. And Job in that way sort of is in communion with David, in that Sheol, part of why Sheol is so miserable is you're so far away from God, because God is up in heaven and Sheol is below the earth. You're far away from God. And that then gets built into these other ideas. But yet again, going back to the parable of Lazarus and the rich man, on one hand, the rich man sort of assumes that the bosom of Abraham and Lazarus, who are enjoying this banquet, are somehow in some continuity with the torment that the rich man is in. And then, of course, the rich man continues to try to get Lazarus to do his bidding, to send him back. Well, if someone comes back from the dead, then they'll believe him. And Abraham says, nah, probably not. And so there's tantalizing pictures there too. So we have all of these images. And I think these images are there for our benefit and for our warning that we ought to consider what we do in this world with our lives, because we will be judged. And what we do in this world with our lives will have eternal consequence. Okay, what do you mean by eternal? Well, I'm just going to use the word because that's the only word I'm given. It's consequence in the age to come. Well, does that mean timeless? Does that mean eternal conscious torment? And I can always be asked to speculate, to draw pictures on paper about these things, but I would rather just sort of use the images that the Bible provides and sort of the things they demark, and say, well, this is sort of what we know. And this, again, is a sort of a different approach, shows my Protestantism, because Protestants tend to be minimalists, where we look at the teachings of the church fathers and we look at teachings of the church, and that sort of happens with purgatory. As a Protestant, I can very much understand how ideas of purgatory make a lot of sense, because will my moral self be instantly transformed, and how will that self be in continuity with my present morally fallible self? Purgatory makes a lot of sense. Okay, I'm going to need some time to get up to speed. The Protestant reformers didn't like purgatory because it isn't in Scripture. And so what tends to happen in Protestantism is that you tend to have two levels. You'll say, okay, this is what Scripture teaches. That creates sort of a minimal outline or framework. And on the basis of that outline or framework, I can certainly make some speculations. And church fathers made speculations, and I'm sure that they were wiser and better educated and more read than I, so maybe I should prefer their speculations to mine. But part of what happens in Protestantism is we say, we won't hold these speculations against you, and we won't hold them to you, and we won't hold the members of our church to those speculations either. Because there was a sense in Protestantism that 1,500 years of continued speculation and teaching and decision-making about what's in the Bible has kind of created too much cruft, and maybe we should clear out some of that and stick to what's in the book instead of what we've been piling on. But of course, Protestants have had their own 500 years to do some piling themselves, so we don't necessarily escape the problem. It seems it first came about for those spiritual beings involved in the wicked affairs of men, as they could not die like men, and it ends with the lake of fire becoming first for Satan and those with him, and then humans are rebellious with him and not faithful to God. Okay, well, the Gideons are, I had a friend, a good friend of mine in this church who, the Gideons are an interesting organization. They're known for giving out their Bibles, and they're a wonderful organization. But the Gideons have, in their own organization, a couple of things. Number one, pastors can't be Gideons. Gideons, to be a Gideon, you need to be a businessman, which is interesting. It's very 19th, early 20th century. So you need to be a layman. You need to be a businessman. And one of the things that you need to sign on to be a Gideon, is the literal lake of fire. And you just know that the founders of the Gideons, that was a very big deal at their time in church history. And it's knowing when the Gideons arose, it's right in the middle of the modernist fundamentalist fight. So what is it when we say literal lake of fire? Where is this lake of fire located in this universe that we have plotted out? Is it on the earth? Is it in the moon? Is it a representation? Are we going to throw them all into the sun? That's sort of like a lake of fire. It's a ball of fire. And so I think we're best off understanding that image, like many images in the book of Revelation, to be an image. And I don't buy that, and I think this is what Tim Keller intended to say, I don't discount its reality. It just, when we get into this constant debate between image and reality, we expose our modernist materialist presuppositions. And so I think Tim Keller was right in saying, well, that basically a lake of fire doesn't sound like a nice place to be. Okay. And so why would the devil and his angels and those who are in rebellion with God all go to the same place? Well, probably because they're living the same thing. And to think of it more symbolically, to be near to God is to be near the source of all joy and light and peace and goodness. And to be far from God is both cold, where there's gnashing of teeth, and fire, where our own desires consume us. And again, C.S. Lewis in his book, The Great Divorce, you know, treated some of those issues nicely. That, well, how can hell be both cold and hot? Well, it's cold because we're divorced from the warmth of God, and it's hot because now that we are no longer distracted by the warmth and goodness of God, we are sort of left to our own desires, and so our desires consume us. But I think if we add some of the Verveke stuff about addiction being reciprocal narrowing, we can sort of map that onto C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce, in that hell is a tiny, tiny, tiny place. And so on the field trip up to the foothills of heaven, someone is desperately trying to bring, I don't remember what it was, an apple or something, desperately trying to get it onto the bus. And one of the beings of light says, you just don't understand the scale of this, that there's no room in your world for even that piece of fruit in this world, because your world is so tiny. It's so cold because it's far from God, and it's tiny because you've been reciprocally narrowing down into nothingness, and darkness is coming. So many of these debates that we're having about annihilationism, eternal conscious torment, some of what we're doing is pitting some of this imagery against each other. If we want to get binary with it, it's like, you want heaven and you don't want hell. You want God and you don't want the community of those who have finally said, I don't want anything to do with you. I want to be me. Well, okay. Well, you is a pretty shallow pond. Most of us look at each other and say, no, I don't want to be you. I want to be me. Well, all of us wanting to be me doesn't end well either, which again, C.S. Lewis nicely portrays. And Melly continues, as for me, I am leaning more towards annihilation as being the second death, but it still seems strange that there be a resurrection for judgment just to die a second time. Yeah, and again, I think if you understand the storyline, why do we have people show up in court for their sentencing? I think we have them show up in court because that's what's just. That's what's fair. You don't want to be sitting in your cell and get a text from the judge, oh, by the way, it's life without parole. No, show up in court, stand there in your flesh, face your maker, get a chance to make your case. I mean, this is the crazy thing about God. He, on one hand, he's sterner than we think is fair, but he's more merciful than we think is responsible. I mean, that's the continual complaint I hear from people out there with respect to God. First of all, I don't believe in God. Well, why? Because I don't believe God would let the world run this far out of control with this much suffering. Oh, you think he's too permissive? Yeah, that's why I can't believe in him. He's too permissive. Oh, okay. And I also really hate the God of the Old Testament because he's too judgmental. Oh, so on one hand, he's too permissive for allowing the world to be like this. On the other hand, this canonical writing that Christians embrace, he's too judgmental. Yeah. So you're against him on both counts. Yeah. Okay. So I don't think he's there. Okay. So I don't think, I just did the Susan Blackmore commentary. I don't think there's any purpose in the universe. Therefore, I should go out and act with purpose. And Jordan Peterson laughs because you're making my point. You can't live, and C.S. Lewis made the same point, you can't live without purpose. And so, yeah, we've got all sorts of speculation about what God will do with this dispensation. Now, and again, if you follow down a lot of the different lines, sometimes it's, well, God will judge us according to, even if God judges us according to what we ourselves hold others to, that's basically what Jesus says in the Sermon on the Mount. Judge not that you be not judged, because you will be judged by the measure that you use against others, and God, who is God, will hold it against you. So be careful with your judgments. And so with all of the speculation about, you know, the justice of God with eternal conscious torment or annihilationism or all of this stuff, we can sit here and speculate. But as a Protestant especially, I prefer to stick to the Bible and try to use the texts that we've been given. And when people ask me for pastoral interpretation, which, you know, that's sort of part of the job, and because people read it and they're like, this is a big book and it's confusing and there's a lot of images and how can I put it together? And I'll have to say first, well, I'll try to answer your question, but understand that my answers are going to be limited. I'll do the best I can for you, but finally, when it comes right down to it, you're in God's hands. And that then, you have to ask the question, what kind of God is it? And as a Christian, I feel very comfortable saying that Jesus is the Son of God. What do I mean by the Son of God? Well, the prince comes to the far out regions of the great king and represents the king. And we know the king by his son. And so when I look at Jesus, I say, okay, if God looks like Jesus, and if Jesus is God, well, on one hand, I do want to live up to his image, and I am confident that he will finally do what's right. And now there are others who will say, oh, I've read that Jesus and I don't trust him. Oh, okay. Well, what kind of God do you imagine there is? Well, there's no God. It's just chaos. Oh, okay. So what then is reasonable if it's just chaos? And that's, I think, where Dostoevsky says, well, it's sort of reasonable if it's all just chaos to delight my passions. Okay. It's also reasonable because one of the passions might be self-righteousness and pride. And so I'm going to be moral in order to be proud of myself and indulge in my own self-righteousness. The difficulty with that path is that path of proud moral self-righteousness also makes it difficult to love other people, because you're going to look around at your moral inferiors, and even if you say, I'm non-judgmental, I really hate those other people who are judgmental. You just can't escape this stuff. So she continues, I'm also a bit drawn to how I understand the Eastern Orthodox view. There's a cool chair video on YouTube about the Eastern Orthodox view, where all men are there, but it seems it's not a welcome place to those who are not faithful in this life and do not experience the fire in this life that burns in the flesh and moves into things of the spirit willingly now. And actually, there's a blog post that I wrote in the 90s on my blog about, or maybe it's the early 2000s, about heaven and hell. And I make that a similar point to that, where people imagine eternal reward to be something like Santa Barbara, which is this gorgeous place where everyone wants to live, in California, and hell to be something more similar to Stockton. So sorry, folks who are from Stockton, which isn't a place in California that people necessarily want to live. But what's as a secular argument and illustration, what's happening there is that there's a neutrality to it. And it's similar to the idea that, well, if you're intrigued and fascinated and drawn to and in love with the God of the Bible as revealed in Jesus Christ, then you know, and Dante sort of paints this, then everything in that realm is going to be in celebration of him. So why, if you can't stand him, why would you want to be there? And that then sets up this whole image of, well, what's outer darkness? Well, it's being utterly far away from the source of goodness and light and life. Well, why is that flame and weeping and gnashing of teeth? Because they no longer have God to direct their attention and draw their focus and inspire their love, and now they're just all working from their own resources, and so they're getting smaller and smaller and darker, and they're just, you know, it's sort of the end state of an addict. And there are many ways to portray that in terms of imagination. So, yeah, I'm going to spend most of my time on one question, it appears. But it's a deep and good question that many people ask. And so I don't mind. I also don't mind not getting to all the questions because some of them are really hard. And there's always sort of a stump the chump type of thing with these questions and answers, which is part of the game and part of fun. But it's, yeah. So the next question, yes and no's, Matthew, could you briefly explain what presuppositionalism is and what your thoughts on it are? Well, my tradition tends to be presuppositionalist, which means that reason almost always builds on certain things. It builds on certain foundations and it builds towards certain goals. Reason is a process of creating arguments and moving arguments in a certain direction. And presuppositionalists tend to recognize that reason is always directed towards something. Directed towards what? Okay, so if I want to know the way to San Jose, reason dictates that I call up Google Maps. That's what reason does. But my desire to go to San Jose, does that come from reason? Well, maybe if I want to see the Winchester Mystery House and I'm curious about it, but you keep pushing it back and there's always some desire that I want or goal that I'm pursuing or good that I want to pursue. And so in that sense, presuppositionalists say there's always these givens that we start with that we don't reason our way there. And again, because it's fresh in my mind, the unbelievable conversation between Susan Blackmore and Jordan Peterson, that's a point that Jordan Peterson makes again and again and again. And so Jordan Peterson often argues as a presuppositionalist because he says this this telos, this eschaton that Sam Harris imagines he can arrive at via reason and well-being just doesn't cut it because well-being itself is too, it's not full enough. And that gets at Chesterton's observation that so often people, we know the good by the negation of the bad. And so I had dental work this week and my mouth is still a little sore. And so what, goodness is no dental work? No, I needed dental work because I had a toothache and I had a cracked tooth and the tooth needed to come out. And so, well, are dentists good or not good? Well, I'll tell you, when I was back in the chair for an hour with that thing propping over my mouth, because the tooth is well in the back of my mouth, and the dentist and his assistant are, you know, trying to get my old stubborn tooth out of there and, you know, trying to suture the hole and put, you know, all of this. I mean, it's just like, man, there was an hour of 1 hour of conscious torture, but they weren't trying to torture me. They had Novocaine, they had all these things, but, you know, it wasn't much fun. Well, there's all these presuppositions beneath the rationality. So where does rationality come in? Well, it was reasonable for me to go to the dentist, and it was reasonable for me to endure the hour in the hopes that, now I don't have the kind of aching I had before, but now I've got the wound in my mouth that is slowly healing, and. So any questions? I always like to get anybody want to have something to say from the group about either of my two answers? Nobody wants to talk about heaven and hell? I'm surprised. Wow. Either that or I can't hear you.
It's a big topic, and I think you answered it really well. I can't think of a question to ask you about it, though.
Okay, Valerie. I'll keep going then. Alan says, oh, good. This is cue for Paul. These are hard questions. Stump the chump. Okay. To what extent are we the image of the Creator? This question, you know, you guys keep asking these age-old questions that come up again and again and again. And if you look at one really fun thing to look at is the history of biblical interpretation, because, and there are commentaries that are devoted to it, because one of the interesting things about the Bible is we always see it through our own questions. And so some have imagined that, you know, if God is reason, then our rational faculty is the image of God. And so image of God has been debated again and again. More contemporary than, of course, in modernism and archaeology, unearth ancient texts, and okay, how did images function sociologically in the ancient Near East? How did images function in Saddam Hussein's Iraq? What does it mean in the text that we are in the image of God? And a lot of those definitions have to do with our role as vice regents or sovereigns over the earth, where we are given dominion over the earth. And again, it's so fascinatingly inconsistent to, on one hand, say, I hate Christianity because Genesis has all those dominion passages. So what we really need to do is fix the earth in this way. Oh, so you're going to undo the dominion of your ancestors using your own dominion. It's like fighting a flood with water. And, you know, fair enough. But we have dominion over the earth. And every time people want to either rescue nature or improve nature, or, you know, they exercise that dominion even while they complain about it. So current ideas of the image of the Creator, and so many of the things, I would say all of the above to a lot of these questions. Our capacity for reason, we certainly, I think, our image in that sense almost always points to uniquenesses that we possess as opposed to everything else we find around us, including the animal kingdom. That might be one way to summarize the whole history of interpretation, because that tended to be the kinds of things that when people were, for whatever reason, tagging image bearing as being, it was usually a way that we are distinct from the animal kingdom and the rocks and the trees. There are Jesus quotes that lean me towards the church being underachievers. I understand there is one that gists, you guys will do cooler stuff than this, for example. Yeah. Cooler, greater. And, you know, that can be understood in many different ways. Is the, for example, the development of modern medicine attributable to the attributable to the followers of Jesus? I'd say, yeah. And Jesus heals the sick. And, you know, we've done penicillin and sanitation. And is that what Jesus had in mind? I don't know. But that's some pretty cool stuff that we've done. And so, in a sense, Jesus symbolizes and dramatizes a lot of what the church does. And so when a church feeds the community, well, they're sort of reenacting the Jesus feeding the 5,000. And when a church cares for the sick, well, we're reenacting the inaugurated eschatology of Jesus healing the people in a village. So, yeah. The one that really grabs me, though, is the mustard seed one. He says, verily, verily. And everyone treats it like a parable. Good point. Well, it's a metaphor and it's an image. So, yeah, truly, truly, I say to you. How much like Jesus do you think we can get, particularly along the lines of healing the sick and turning over money lenders' tables? With respect to the people in Redding, California, and Bethel Church, I think they're right that we are timid with respect to the power I think Jesus offers. Kind of critiquing them, I don't know that organizing ourselves in the way that they are will somehow empty the hospitals and banish COVID from our midst. Because it seemed to me that Jesus' miracles were almost always samples. So if I go to Costco and pre-COVID, I go up and down the aisles to do my shopping at Costco, and they have these people there with these little trays and they're giving out samples. And I think in some ways, Jesus' parables were samples. They were tastes of the kingdom. They were enacted parables. They were designed to show Jesus and his mission and the heart of God. But as I've argued many times, Jesus doesn't provide them with public sanitation, which could have cured a tremendous amount of disease. They had certain forms of sanitation in the Roman world, obviously. Jesus could have said, yeah, you know, all the lead you're using in those Roman pipes, that's going to be a problem. Jesus doesn't do that. Jesus doesn't say, you know, here's how you can sort of work penicillin. Jesus doesn't do that. What is Jesus doing? Jesus is pointing to himself. And I think there was recently an examination of a woman who is going to be a commissioned pastor right here in Sacramento area, right here in my cluster. She teaches Old Testament at William Jessup University. And one of the things that she threw out in her classical examination was she's a secessionist. And I thought, oh boy, you know, when you offer those kind of things in a classical exam, you're being pretty gutsy, because that's going to stick in the back of everybody's mind. I'm not a secessionist. I think Jesus' power remains available today to Christians, and I've seen Christians use it well, and I've seen Christians use it poorly. And I think that delights the heart of God, and I think those are signs to a secular age that we don't know so much. And I think, I said to my men's group the other night, I know people, and this gets into the next question, which I don't know if I'll get into fully or two questions from now. People read the Old Testament and they, on one hand, they shudder. Oh, God just told Israel to wipe out this people. And Samuel comes and Saul has, you know. Here's the thing about everybody loves equality and equity. Right now, a lot of people do. here's the thing about equity. When God announces the ban on the Amorites, that's equitable. When God announces the ban on Jericho and says, wipe it out, anything that you can't destroy, devote to the Lord. What does that mean? It goes into the tabernacle treasury. And Achan, of course, goes and takes the gold and the silver. Well, what normally happened when you overcome an adversary? Well, it's terribly unequitable because you look around and you say, all right, the healthy children and the desirable women, we'll take them, and the degree to which we can subjugate the men into slaves, we'll take them, and the nicer clothing and the gold and the silver. You basically, human beings, pick things apart with respect to value and say, I'll take this. And so when God announces the ban on something, he says, nope, you're going to destroy this city and you're not going to profit from it. You're going to destroy this city at probably the loss of some of your lives and at the expense and risk of many of your lives, and you're not going to get a single thing out of it. You are not going to benefit from the annihilation of these people. And in the ancient world, people would have been like, well, I don't like that deal. What's the point of raiding and pillaging if I can't feather my nest? Oh no, equity. None of you are going to get anything from it, but you must do it. And so Saul keeps the king and some of his choicest flocks, and Samuel comes around and says, Saul, you're corrupt. These were all under the ban. You're not supposed to benefit from it. And in fact, the soldiers who were the ones who actually put their lives at risk by defeating this enemy didn't benefit from it, and you do? So, you know, a lot of these injustices that we point out, well, fair enough. We certainly see the point. But the crazy thing about justice is that there are often far more subtle injustices beneath the surface. And so, all credit to the woke folks. Well, they like pointing out those injustices. But the difficulty with playing that game is there are almost always more injustices to be pointed out. And again, back to Jesus with respect to judgment. People who relish pointing out the sins of others had better be very careful, because, okay, you're really good at identifying everybody else's sin. God is going to come and say, wow, you're really good at identifying everybody else's sin. I can do that too. Watch me do it to you. Yeah, we don't like that. So, yeah. Oh, I'm almost out of time. Any follow-ups, or if you want to get a question in under the wire, now's your chance. All right.
Quiet group today.
Yeah, it's a quiet group today. What does the Protestant, and specifically the little R Reformed Church in the U.S., do to communicate transcendence of God in the non-Christian, culture that surrounds it? It's a great question. To the nonconformity tends to communicate transcendence effectively. And that's part of really the power of the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics, because they can be nonconforming in certain ways. Now, certain Protestant churches can also be very nonconforming to the culture. So I would say, to the degree that a church tradition obnoxiously and stubbornly refuses to conform to an ascendant cultural norm, is the degree that that church is communicating something of God's transcendence. Now, there are certain groups of people that are enormously nonconforming, and they might not, in fact, be communicating anything about God. They're just communicating that they're stubborn and SOBs. So And this is part of the reason why you will often notice among celebrity atheists a certain begrudging acknowledgement to the non-conforming religious people around them, because they look at that and say, well, at least those people take themselves seriously. And that was in some ways Rod Dreher's story when he switched from Roman Catholic to Orthodox, because he went to his Orthodox priest and said, you know, I'm married to my wife and we'd like to practice, you know, Roman Catholic social planning and marital practice. And so we'd like instruction from you, our priest, about, you know, basically not using birth control in the prescribed Roman Catholic way. And the Roman Catholic priest rolled his eyes and said, oh, you're one of them. And at that point, Rod Dreher says, you're not communicating transcendence. I'm out of here. And hey, say what you want about the Orthodox. You know, I just watched Peugeot's pandemic storytelling video. As I saw it, it appeared, and it was like the first day out at like 12,000 views already. I thought, ooh, this one's got to be a good one. And it did not disappoint. And that's part of the attraction and power of Jonathan Peugeot, in that he's standing out like a sore thumb in the culture. And it's the same thing about Peterson. When Peterson, you know, basically said, you know, I'm not going to use those pronouns because I'm not going to give in to prescribed speech, that there's a power in that nonconformity that draws all of our attention, and we say, oh, he's serious and he's willing to suffer for it. That communicates transcendence, because what they are saying is, the culture is just going about its business, but this is from outside and they're serious and they're signaling to all of us. And it's especially effective when someone is mostly like us and we expect them to cave like all the other wusses around, but they dig in. And again, sometimes this is just plain old stubbornness and we get used to that, and they're not communicating anything that we're valuing as transcendent. But yeah, that's how churches can communicate transcendence. So, all right, I've gone on an hour. So before I end the recording, Rick didn't show up today. I don't know what's going on. So I just recorded this on my own, and I think he was complaining about the sound when we're doing it the way we're doing it before. And I know that just doing it on my own computer now, I've got the sound directly from my mic. So we'll see what Rick has to say about that. But otherwise, I'll end the recording and stay for a few minutes to chat, because Joey says it's always better when I leave. So maybe I'll lurk or something, but I've got other work I need to do. So
thank you, Paul.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure. All right, I'll end the recording.